And now it is my pleasure to invite Charles Duhigg, author of Smarter, Faster, Better, a Pulitzer Prize winning author, I might add, and moderator Farhad Manju to the stage.
Well, Farhad's getting clipped in. Hi, thank you so much for coming. It's a pleasure to see all of you.
Hi, everyone. So your book is called Smarter, Faster, Better, and the subtitle is The Secrets of Being Productive in Life and Business. But I really think it should have been called Smarter, Faster, Better, The Charles Duhigg Story, because you are not someone that I would have picked as, like, worrying about being productive. we both work at the Times. You've sort of been done really well at the Times. You won a Pulitzer Prize for this series on Apple and Apple's production around the world and its labor relations. You wrote a previous book that was a bestseller about habits. We were at an event recently, and someone came up to you and told you that book, like, literally changed his life. He needed to work out, and he said basically you, like, saved his life because he read this book. So then I read the introduction, and you say in the introduction that you, like everyone else, you know, was worried about, like, you felt like you were just sort of not surviving.
That's totally accurate. Let me apologize in advance. I have allergies. Does anyone else here have allergies? If you hear, yeah, a couple, everyone's like, yes. So do we. If you hear me hacking, it's because I have allergies, not because I'm offended by anything or contagious with anything that I'll pass on to any of you. So that year that we were working on the iEconomy, and there were a lot of people who were working on that series for the Times, was 2012. And that's the same year that The Power of Habit came out. And I had spent a couple of years writing The Power of Habit, and I didn't know if anyone would read it. And then I published it, and I was lucky in that a number of people had read it, and they sent me emails saying that they liked it. Hey, Quinn. And then our late arrival. And then I was working on the iEconomy series, which went on to win the Pulitzer Prize. And so professionally, it was a fantastic year. And I would come home every night, at like 6:30 or so, and we had a brand new, our second son had just been born recently, and I would say to my wife, you know, if this is what success feels like, then, like, sign me back up for failure, because this is the worst lifestyle I've ever had. Because I would get home at 6:30 or 7, and I'd have like 100 emails to deal with that night. And there were like 5 things I wanted to do during the day that I hadn't gotten to. And all I really wanted to do was sit down and, like, have a glass of wine and, like, get to know my kids. And it was just terrible. And so about 6 months into this year, like the year of living hell, as I started referring to it, where, like, everything was going great, by the way. Like, I was super lucky to have this year. I was like, I got to figure out what the hell's going on, because this does not seem like this is how life is supposed to work. And so I reached out to this guy named Atul Gawande, who's a writer for The New Yorker and a surgeon.
One of those people where you see his byline and you hear everything he does, and you're like, wow, he's kind of an amazing person. He has it everything down.
That's exactly right. And that's what, and like, I couldn't be like, can you tell me your secrets? So what I did was I said, can I ask for some publishing advice? Which is actually like journalist code for can you tell me your secrets? And so I sent him this email, and I was like, can I ask for some publishing advice? And he sent something back that said, I'd love to talk to you, but I'm too busy right now. I hope you don't mind. And we have this friend in common, this guy named David Siegel. I'd never met Atul, but I said to David Siegel in the newsroom, I was like, you know, Atul said he didn't have time to talk to me. Totally understand. He's probably like saving lives at Harvard or writing another like best-selling book or whatever it is. And David said, oh, no. Actually, Atul mentioned that you had emailed him. It's that he's going to a rock concert with his kids tonight, and he's going on a quick Bahamas vacation with his wife this weekend. And as soon as David said that, I was like, I am an idiot. I have no idea, like, what the hell I'm doing in this world. So that's when I decided to start actually asking researchers about why some people are more productive than others. And it turns out there are reasons why some people are more productive than others. So,
right.
So I felt like that was really useful.
And and then you wrote a book about it.
And then I wrote a book about it. And I wrote a book about it.
So one of my favorite parts of your book was this chapter on focus. And you talk about sort of two productions that people are huge fans of that have been very successful. For me, like, I guess for a lot of people here, like, West Side Story is sort of the bigger one. But for me, Frozen was sort of the thing that, like, I have a 3-year-old daughter, and Frozen is, like, her entire universe. Like, I think, like, I think she thinks that Elsa and Anna are, like, real people that she would prefer over her parents. So I was surprised, like, you describe how they actually had a lot of problems putting together Frozen. It was not like this miraculous success from the start. And you use this to describe how you can be productive in creativity.
That's exactly. So there's this one idea sort of underlying. There's eight. As I was talking to people, I kept on hearing these same things come up again and again in different words. And these eight ideas in particular kept on coming up. So those were the eight chapters of the book. And one of them is about creativity. Because as everyone in this room knows, we are living through this economic revolution right now, right? That will be seen as being, I think economists agree, as profound as the Industrial Revolution and the Agrarian Revolution. And the thing about an economic revolution is that in retrospect, it looks awesome. And while you're living through it, it feels very anxiety-producing. And in many ways, the definition of productivity, a fight over the definition of productivity, forcing people to redefine it, is the very nature of what an economic revolution is. And so there are these eight things that kept on coming up, that basically the nature of these eight things are changing. And the people who understand that they're changing, who understand how to redefine them, who understand the science and the neurology behind those things, those are the people who will end up succeeding. Probably most of you are already succeeding because you understand on an intuitive level that things like creativity and innovation are disproportionately important today in a way that they never have been before. Which then adds this question, what's the formula for things like creativity? Or what's the formula for focus or for self-motivation? So when it comes to creativity, there was this story about Frozen. I reached out to the Disney folks and because someone had mentioned this to me, that Frozen, this thing that we all think of as a huge blockbuster, was actually on the brink of catastrophe until just months before it was in theaters. And when I was asking Disney how they create a process that helps them be creative on demand, one of the people there said, oh, well, you know, if you really want to understand it, you got to look at West Side Story. So I went and I started looking at West Side Story. West Side Story, anyone here ever heard of West Side Story? It's a... Anyone?
No, what is it?
Anyone here perform in West Side Story when you were in high school? Yeah? Anyone else? What character were you?
Diesel.
Wow.
Yeah, nice. Well done, my friend. Maria? Or the other character that I love from West Side Story named Arab? I do not know why he's called Arab, but that's a character in West Side Story. So the story of West Side Story starts in 1949 when there's these three guys. Arthur Lawrence, who wrote the book. Lenny Bernstein, who wrote the music. And Jerry Robbins, who's the choreographer. And Jerry Robbins is really the intellectual driver behind West Side Story. And in 1949, he gets together with his two other friends. They haven't met Stephen Sondheim yet. He's a young guy. And he says, look, I've got this idea. I want to do something completely new in musical theater. I want to create the avant-garde on Broadway. And so they start coming up with this entirely new language. They want to create everything new for West Side Story. They want it to be so breathtakingly original that you couldn't watch that and imagine any other musical on that stage. And for the next 9 years, they pass the script back and forth between themselves. And so 2 weeks before the show is supposed to premiere, it premieres in Washington, D.C., because that's where they do the tryouts. 2 weeks before the show is supposed to premiere, Jerry Robbins gets together with his colleagues and he says, fellas, this show is terrible. This is going to bomb like nobody's business. And the reason it's going to bomb is because we have tried to be too new. There is one copy of the original script of West Side Story in existence. It's the New York Public Library. And if you go and you ask to see it, they'll take you into this room where they give you like white gloves to handle the script. And then they leave so you can pull out your iPhone and start taking pictures of the pages, which is fantastic, but don't tell them I did it. And if you read the original script, it has this crazy vocabulary. They literally created an entirely new vocabulary for these gang members to speak. They would say things like skip the frabba jabba or cracko jacko. This is the first time that cracko jacko as a phrase is written in some type of dramaturge.
It sounds like New York Post headlines.
Yeah, it's exactly. It's like New York Post headlines, except that it's like so new that nobody has any idea, like, and so Jerry Robbins says to them, like, this is too new. It's not going to work. Nobody's going to understand this. So he says, let's try and rewrite this thing. So over the next 2 weeks, they come up with a brand new opening for West Side Story. If you were sitting in that theater and you came in and you watched this, for the first 9 minutes of this musical, you would see not one person speak. But you would see people who were dressed just like the teenagers that you see all the time, the teenagers that are right outside the theater doors. And they're moving like classical ballet dancers. They're moving in these ways that you, as a theater-going audience, know are echoes of Swan Lake in the Nutcracker Suite. This became known as the West Side Story prologue. And this transforms musical theater. Every single piece of theater that comes after this in some way has to respond to what happened on that stage. But what's fascinating about it is the reason why it's so transformative is not because it's completely new and original. It's because it took this cliched language, this cliched visual vocabulary of classical dance, and these cliched costumes of like what teenagers dress like, and it jammed them together on the stage. And it turns out, as researchers have looked at how innovation happens, not just how a spark of brilliance happens, but how companies can innovate on demand, on schedule, how innovation becomes more productive. What they found is this, that the most innovative companies are the companies that recognize that to be new, you don't create something out of whole new cloth. You take established ideas and you put them together in new ways. In fact, there's a word for this. They're called innovation brokers. People who are good at putting their feet in multiple camps and finding ideas that everyone who knows that idea already says, oh, that's old news, and putting them together in ways that nobody imagined before. And the power of innovation brokers is so strong that studies show that you can actually count the number of innovation brokers in a company and forecast how many patents that company will get or how much we'll see an uptick over the first year after the company goes public. This is what innovation really is, and there is a formula to it.
So one of the things I wondered as I read this is, does this, should we discount innovation? Because, like, should we just say, like, oh, that's a sample. Like, Kanye is just, like, choosing music from somewhere else. He heard it, he heard a bunch of things. He put them all together in one song. There's nothing new here. Like, I guess what I'm wondering is, like, how do you know when something's novel rather than, like, truly novel and groundbreaking rather than just a bunch of samples?
So I think that's a good question, and I guess I'll challenge the premise a little bit, because I think that the first thing is that we all know that not all combinations work, right? There's this famous case of Nestle coming out with what's called Bacon Baby, which was bacon-flavored instant formula.
Wait, and that didn't work?
It didn't work. It didn't work. Shocker. I think the babies liked it. It was just the parents who were like, what? I would have liked it. So not all combinations work, right? And we've all, like, gone to, like, terrible art student shows where they just, like, throw ideas together. But I think that what this idea is saying, this idea of innovation brokerage, is it's actually saying that the new thing oftentimes is the combination. It's recognizing how knowledge should fit together in new ways. And my favorite example of this is in the early 1970s, there were a bunch of economists, mostly in Israel, who were like looking for, one of them had been hired to screen people in the Israeli military trying to figure out like how to use them. And he was an economist, and so it was kind of a weird job to give him. And then he gets hired by a university. He's looking for something that will get him tenure. And he had taken all these psych classes. And in one of his psych classes, a teacher had said, like, there's all these questions in psychology we don't understand, like why smart people buy lottery tickets, because that's a dumb idea. Who in this room has bought a lottery ticket in the last 6 months? Okay, you're smart people. You know you're not going to win, right? And so he said,
have you ever been in an audience and then someone actually had won the lottery?
And someone was like, $13 million. no, never. Odds are very low that's going to happen.
One day.
But this guy says, like, I'm just going to take the questions of psychology and apply classical economic tools to them. And that's Daniel Kahneman. That's the birth of behavioral economics. And I don't think anyone would say behavioral economics just seems like sampling, right? I don't think anyone would say Kanye isn't a genius, a super weird genius, but a genius nonetheless.
Super weird genius. No, I agree. Yeah.
But it's oftentimes, the point is that the process is actually the innovation, not necessarily the like brainstorm.
Yeah. You know what this reminded me of? Like I write about the tech industry a lot, and I talk to I've often talked to people in tech about sort of why they try to promote diversity, and it often seems like, is it just sort of a like a PC thing? Is it just a public relations thing? But like, yeah, I know you in this book you mentioned Laszlo Bock at Google. One of the things he and his team were telling me is that with a diverse group in a meeting, you get a diversity of ideas. And that sort of suggests what you're talking about, like ideas that come from a bunch of different places, you know, come together in new forms.
That's exactly right. That if everyone in the room has the same experiences, nobody's going to bring an idea that worked in some other realm that everyone else hasn't heard. But I will make a caveat to this, which is the question, like, why was Jerry Robbins, why did he know to combine those things in a way that worked? And here's what I'd suggest. So Jerry Robbins is like the perfect innovation broker. He was trained in classical dance for basically his entire life. But he was also this guy who loved to go to these jitterbug contests that they had all over New York. And none of his friends would go with him to the jitterbug contest because they all looked down their nose at it. He loved like all these he read Romeo and Juliet, which is what West Side Story is based on. He loved the sort of classical literature, but he also would read all these like dime store novels about like gangs and like torrid romances, and you know the books I'm talking about. Right. He was openly bisexual at a time when homosexuality was illegal. He would go to these meetings of the Communist Party, not because he was super into communism. This ended up being an issue because he was called before HUAC. But he just loved going to things where people argue with each other all the time. And basically, if you go to a meeting of a Communist Party, everyone's going to argue. And then they'll go home and they'll have sex with each other, which he also thought was pretty cool. So he's basically this guy who is an innovation broker, right? Any of us can become that. But so what did Jerry Robbins do that was different from anyone else, in addition to exposing himself to a whole bunch of ideas, having this diversity of experiences? Jerry Robbins would go home after going to like jitterbug contests, and he would write these insanely long letters to his friends, like 30 or 40 page letters. And these letters were so long that his friends would write things back that said things like, "I read the first 6 pages of your letter and then I threw the rest away. Let me tell you what I think so far." Because they were just too long. And this is what Jerry Robbins did differently. And this is kind of a theme consistently about productivity. He had this contemplative routine, what psychologists refer to as a thinking habit, that forced him to think about what he had just seen. So he goes to a seated jitterbug contest, and then he makes himself write a long letter about it and process that information he was just exposed to. That's why he's able to see these combinations where other people can't. That's what's different. Similarly, Kanye's weird eccentricities, like we tend to say like, oh, he's so productive, he's such a genius. The eccentricity is like a something he can indulge. But that's not right. The eccentricity is actually a contemplative routine. The forcing yourself to write long letters or forcing yourself to you know, make these weird public pronouncements and do things that shock other people. That's how you force yourself to think half an inch deeper about the ideas you're being exposed to. That's why you recognize that classical ballet plus teenagers equals something interesting.
Right. Another one of the 8 ideas has to do with focus. And this is something I think we all worry about, especially nowadays when we're focused on multiple different things, devices, electronic devices usually, and they're all sort of, we're constantly distracted and we're not sort of, we don't know how often our lack of focus or the fact that we're kind of tunneling, as you call it, into one specific thing is like causing difficulty in the rest of our lives. You have some specific examples of how things went totally wrong and how things can go correctly when you focus, when people learn how to focus.
So, and let me ask a question before, and for everyone in the audience as well as for you, Farhad, because you tweet a lot.
I do.
Do you say that like a man who's been in the salt mines? I do.
I'm not proud of it. No.
Do you enjoy tweeting?
Oh yeah, I totally. I mean, the reason I do it is because I like it more than anything else in the world.
His wife will never listen to this interview. And what is it that you like about it? Like, what do you enjoy?
This is difficult. You're putting me on the spot. It's a way to like instantly try out ideas. Like, it's like little riffs, and you get instant feedback from a lot of people. It's kind of like being, I think, probably what stand-up is. Like, you can try out a lot of things. You get people telling you that you've bombed most of the time. But sometimes you feel really good about, like, an idea or, like, a joke or just, like, saying something. Like, I'm a columnist, so I have to, like, come up with a new idea every week. And I, like, often just, like... Like, these aren't... A lot of them aren't related to, like, my work. But, like, I often just, like, try out ideas there.
That's interesting. So that's kind of a contemplative routine for you. Is like
it is. Yes, that's a good way of putting it. Yes, I hadn't even thought of that.
It's not a bad thing. You're not wasting time.
Yeah. No, it is a bad thing because I like do it the way that I write. Actual the thing that I get paid for is like I write three words and then I tweet. Like I cannot write anything without like looking at Twitter. So it's like a contemplative routine that has taken over my life.
So I don't think it's a terrible thing.
But enough about me.
So, I definitely won't tell your editors that. So there's an interesting thing about the Twitter, and I think what's going on right now really plays into it. How many people in the audience work in the tech industry? Like work with things? Literally everyone just raised their hand. How many people are worth more than $10 billion in this audience? Like again, like 30 hands. So so a millennia ago, if Twitter existed, it would be fantastic because a millennia ago, if you were someone who could multitask, you had a huge advantage over everyone else. If you could plant crops and look for predators at the same time, you like were way ahead of anyone who could just plant crops or just look for predators, right? You were like killing it every
single day.
Hunter
and gatherer.
Hunter and gatherer. You're like, kill it. So evolutionarily, our brains have evolved to love this instinct for multitasking. Neurologically, we can sort of prove that this novelty contains inherent seeds of reward. And until like 50 years ago, that was fantastic because busyness and productivity were essentially synonymous, even through the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. But then something starts happening, and in particular, this begins accelerating in the last 15 or 20 years, which is that busyness and productivity are no longer synonymous. Right, and this instinct that we have to multitask, this love of novelty and the fast feedback loop, which is essentially programmed into our neurology, becomes a disadvantage for anyone who has ever spent, like, said, like, I'm going to go on Facebook for 5 minutes, which is actually impossible, right? Like, nobody goes for 5 minutes, you go for 45 minutes, or you tweet constantly. So the question is, what do we know about how people counter this neurological impulse to multitask, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, as long as you can control it. And my favorite story about this is the story of Qantas Flight 32, which I think you referred to. Yeah. So Qantas Flight 32, in 2010, there's this plane named Qantas Flight 32 that's takes off from the Singapore airport, and it's headed towards Sydney. It's like a beautiful, clear day when this plane takes off, lifts off into the air, the pilot hits the autopilot. If everything goes according to plan, for the next 8.5 hours, everything will be fantastic. And about 20 minutes into this flight, there's this bang, or a boom, kind of. Boom, bang, you know, whatever.
Nothing let me just good ask, in a plane.
Yeah, not a good noise in a plane. Let me ask, does anyone here get freaked out flying? One person, okay. This story is not going to make you feel any better about flying. There's this boom, and it turns out this happens all the time. If you're a pilot, like, there's oftentimes air pockets move through your jet engine, and you notice it. So they don't freak out too much. But then they hear another bang, and then they hear the sound of thousands of marbles being thrown against the fuselage, the hull of the plane. And what had happened, unbeknownst to them, is that one of the fan blades on the engine had sheared off the turbine and had basically disconnected and had started moving through the plane wing and had punched this huge hole in the wing, a hole actually big enough for a person's body to fit through. In fact, if it was up there, I would show you. One of the passengers actually took a photo out his window of this huge hole that just appeared in the wing, which, again, is not a great thing
to
have
happen.
That's
like a crazy impulse to just take a photo.
That's exactly. They were like,
thing I do before I die is take a picture of this.
Right. Not turn right. around and do the selfie, right? They're like, check out. So it turns out that a hole in a wing is actually not a terrible thing, like not the bad thing that happened on this flight, because an Airbus A380 can actually have a hole in the wing and do just fine. What the bad thing was that when this fan blade had detached, it had hit another blade, and it had caused it to shatter into thousands of pieces. And those thousands of pieces, as they moved through the wing, they were like shrapnel from a bomb getting set off in the wing, and they start cutting through hydraulic lines and electrical lines and fuel lines. And so within about 30 seconds, 22 of the 24 major systems that are needed to keep a flight aloft were suddenly knocked out. It's the worst mid-air mechanical disaster in modern aviation. Now, the guy who's flying this plane is this guy named, I'm about to say Sullenberg. It's not Sullenberg. It's de Crespigny, guy named Richard de Crespigny, who's an Australian guy. And he's an old military guy, military pilot. And de Crespigny is trained in this type of aviation thinking called situational awareness, which I'm sure many of you have heard about. Situational awareness is basically building mental models or telling yourself stories about what's happening as it occurs. And it turns out that most of the studies that we have about how focus works indicates that mental models are at the root of focus. So all of us build mental models every single day, right? We forecast like what's going to happen during the day. I'm going to get on the subway, or I'm going to get on the train, and it's going to take me to this place. People who are particularly good at focusing and particularly good at multitasking are people who build much more detailed mental models, almost habitually or unconsciously. So what we know is that people who are really productive and successful in office settings are usually people who imagine their days with just about 15 degrees more specificity than their colleagues. So instead of saying, like, I'm going to go to that meeting at 10 o'clock, they think to themselves, I'm going to go to that meeting, Jim's going to talk first because he's always like a big loudmouth, and then I'm going to say this thing, and then Susan's going to come in with something, and then I'll say this other thing, and I'll win the meeting, right, or whatever it is. If you're at an investment
I'll
bank.
I'll win the meeting.
Or Twitter, right, where everyone's like apparently battling each other. So this mental model building is incredibly important to how we create and manage focus. So, and it turns out that this guy, de Crespigny, he's actually really big into this thing of building mental models. And he does this thing before every flight, and they had done it before that flight in Singapore, where in the shuttle from the hotel to the tarmac, he'll actually ask his co-pilots to tell him exactly what they're going to do if an emergency occurs. So he says, if engine 2 goes out, tell me the first place your eyes are going to go. What are the first words out of your mouth? Where are you going to put your hands? And he goes through this. He drills people on this. So they basically have these mental scripts, these mental models. And for the first 10 minutes after the emergency occurs, if you listen to the cockpit recordings, that's exactly what happens. Everyone talks as if they're reading from a script. Everyone's calm. Everything happens exactly according to plan. And in 99% of emergencies, that would have been just fine. But in this case, because it's the worst mid-air mechanical disaster in history, what happens is that as they start going through these scripts, the emergencies begin multiplying exponentially. So they solve three problems, and suddenly there's like 15 more problems. And they start going through these scripts. And each time they finish a script, a new script and five more scripts are needed. And so de Crespigny does this kind of interesting thing. They're about 15 minutes into the crisis, and he stops and he takes his hands off of the controls, and he closes his eyes, and he thinks to himself, the mental models that I'm using are getting too complicated. I can't keep track in my brain of this mental picture of a plane with all these mistakes. I need a simpler mental model. And so he decides to start visualizing this Airbus A380 as a Cessna. Now, has anyone ever ridden a Cessna before? Okay, you know, a Cessna is basically like a toy, right? It's hardly even a plane. It's like a paper plane that like somebody like managed to put an engine onto.
And the A380 is like the biggest commercial plane and they fly, right?
The A380 is this incredibly complicated, holds hundreds and hundreds of people, 700 people at max.
Yeah.
It's incredibly complicated. But de Crespigny needs a mental model to help him visualize what's going on. And the thing about a Cessna is that it has three things. It has a navigation system, has the ability to go up and down in the air, and then it has landing gear so it can set down. And when I talked to de Crespigny afterwards, spoiler alert, they all live. When I talked to de Crespigny afterwards, what he told me was that he needed, basically the biggest risk that he faced at that moment was getting overwhelmed by multitasking, right? Was losing the ability to make decisions. Because when you have this panic going on, or when you go into your office and you get 150 emails, and your phone is buzzing in your pocket, and there's people asking you to come sit in on meetings. The easiest thing for us to do is to stop deciding and start reacting. But when you stop deciding and start reacting, that's when you lose control over actually managing the mental models. That's when you hand over control to your environment. So he says to his co-pilots, stop telling me anything about this plane unless you would say it to me if I was flying a Cessna. So by now they've managed to actually turn the plane around. So they're approaching the Singapore runway. They're coming down. Air traffic control actually radios him and says, we recommend that you pull up and abort the landing. At which point, DeKrebny basically tells them to, like, screw off, because, like, that's the wrong thing to tell. They actually used the word, we think you might crash, which apparently you're not supposed to say if you're in traffic control, in the background. So he tells them, like, don't tell me anything that you wouldn't tell a pilot flying a Cessna. As they're approaching the tarmac, this alarm goes off that's called a squealer. A squealer is designed to be so loud and annoying that pilots can't ignore it as long as they're conscious. And it will actually revive you from unconsciousness. It's like the alarm of last resort. And so this goes off, and DeKrebny actually says to his colleagues, ignore the squealer. Because on a Cessna, that wouldn't be happening. And in his mind, he's flying this Cessna, and he brings it down. They come down onto the tarmac. They're going incredibly fast. There's 2,000 meters of tarmac. They're like speeding down the tarmac. DeKrebny doesn't know if the brakes will work at all, because he has no idea if the braking system has been severed by the shrapnel in the wing. But if he was flying a Cessna, what he would do in a Cessna is he would push the brakes once, and he would just hold them down, because that's all you have to do in a Cessna. And so that's what he does. He pushes the brakes once. He holds it down. The middle of the plane starts groaning as it tries to slow down. They're getting closer and closer. The runway is surrounded by these sand dunes. If they hit the sand dunes too fast, the wheels will dig in and the plane will flip over and crush everyone. As they get closer and closer, the plane gets slower and slower. They stop with 100 meters to spare. And 45 minutes later, all 469 people on board walk off safely. And so when I asked DeKrebny, like, how did he do this? Like, even he'll admit, it's not clear that he was managed to land this plane because he thought of it as a Cessna, right? They've recreated this landing in simulators hundreds of times. Every single time, everyone on board dies. They don't know why he was able to land the plane. DeKrebny doesn't know why he was able to land the plane. But what he will say is, the only mistake he could have made at that moment is to stop making decisions. And the only way that he could make decisions is to come up with some mental model, some script that just allows him to decide in split seconds, pay attention to that detail, ignore that one. I can safely put it aside. And that's what happens when we go into work every single day, right? The people who succeed are the ones who say, no, Jim, like, I know that you need my help right now, but that doesn't fit my mental model. Like, I'll call you later. And this email that came in, like, that one fits into my mental model. Like, we don't have this conversation with ourselves unless we're super weird. But but the people who train themselves to do that are the ones who have focus. And so I would guess that you actually have mental models that involve using Twitter, and tell me if I'm wrong on this,
to test very kind out these of you. Ideas. One of the things I couldn't figure out was whether there are some people who are just inherently better at creating these mental models. Because you talk about some pilots who catastrophically didn't make good mental models and crashed.
Air France Flight 447.
Right. And can we learn to make better mental models? Like, is you telling us to make better mental models going to help us tomorrow? Like, is that something that I can do?
Yes, you absolutely can do it. And that's the most interesting thing about this. Is that literally, there's a book, this guy named Eric Anderson, this book that just came out called Peak. You know the 10,000-hour rule that Malcolm Gladwell writes about? That started with this guy, Eric Anders. Anders? Anderson?
I don't know.
Anders Ericsson? That's it, Anders Ericsson. So he is actually basically the father of how mental models create expertise. And he actually has a theory that talent has absolutely nothing to do with becoming an expert. Now, and maybe he overstates his case. Maybe at the margins that, like, I'm not going to be able to compete with Kobe no matter how much I practice on, like, a basketball court. But his point, which is pretty convincing, is that anyone can become better at building mental models. It's all about just practice, making it something that you automatically engage in. And the key to that is literally just telling yourself story, just forcing yourself during your morning commute to try and envision the meeting that's coming up with 5 degrees more specificity than you normally do, that we get into this habit of imagining what's going to happen. And our brain begins automatically allocating our attention and starts saying, like, pay attention to that, ignore that, because we have a story in our head that we're following.
Yeah, what I found interesting here was that a number of the steps, they sound pretty simple to do. Like, another of the recommendations is that I simply sort of ask myself questions about, ask myself questions before I'm going to make a decision so that I have some sort of sense of control over it. So just having some feeling of control over my day and the decision, like, makes me more productive. Even if, like, the actual control that I'm exerting is, like, meaningless to my life, like, just having a sense of control is helpful.
I think that's right, but I don't think you would have a sense of control if it was genuinely meaningless. I mean, so there's a perfect example. There's this oncologist I was talking about. So in the chapter about self-motivation, one of the things that we know is that the basal ganglia, which is where self-motivation sort of originates from, tends to become more active when we feel like we're making choices and we feel in control. And so being in control is critical. Turning a chore into a choice and linking it to something that matters to us is critical in generating self-motivation. So I'm talking to this oncologist, like, very decorated guy. He's at Oxford. And he says he hates grading students' papers because it's super boring. So before he grades students' papers, he has this mantra he goes through where he says to himself, if I grade students' papers, then the university gets to collect tuition dollars. And if the university gets to collect tuition dollars, they can pay for my cancer research. And if they pay for my cancer research, then I get to save people's lives. So grading students' papers means I get to save people's lives. Now, this is not only specious, but, like, moronic for, like, an oncologist to have to tell themselves. But here's the point, is that you're right. Like, finding a choice, like, it doesn't seem like – it seems pretty easy, but we don't do it, right? Like,
right.
Like, a guy with an MD, PhD has to convince himself each time that grading students' papers is worth it, because we tend to lapse into habit. We tend to stop thinking. Our brain loves to conserve cognitive energy whenever it can. And so they do seem like simple things, but they're actually, unless we have these contemplative practices that push us to do it, we don't end up building a mental model because it's so much easier to listen to NPR.
Right.
Or to tweet.
Or to tweet, yes. Do you feel, after doing all this research, did you accomplish what you tried to do, which is, like, make yourself more productive, or at least, like, learn the secrets to being more productive? And are you now?
Yeah, I think I am. You seem skeptical as you ask the question.
Yeah, because I can't tell.
If you have to ask. Yeah, I actually, so I think the biggest difference is that this basic insight is that the more you push yourself to think a little bit more about life, the more you end up making better decisions. The more you think about what your goals are and what your priorities are. So I think that the underlying this is this question of what productivity actually is, right?
Yeah.
That we tend to equate productivity with busyness, and I think that's what I was doing this year that I was miserable, is that I just felt like I was running as hard as I could, and I kept on falling behind because I wasn't actually thinking about what I wanted to do. I wasn't forcing myself to think about what matters to me. And productivity changes from place to place. And, you know, Wednesday morning is like, get your kid to school as fast as possible so you can get to the office and reply to emails. And a Friday morning might be like, I just want to walk my kid to school without feeling stressed so I can talk to them and actually get to know them.
Right.
The more I think the biggest change has been I now have these contemplative routines that force me to think about what I actually want to do instead of reacting.
Yeah, there's a strain of this that I kept thinking of, just sort of being mindful about my life and about my goals, and which is not really what you think of as, like, productivity. It's certainly not what you think of as, like, busyness. Like, you here you're telling us in many different parts to kind of pause and think about our goals, or, like, to create a story, or just be more mindful about kind of life in general.
I think that's right, with one exception, though, which is that I think mindfulness implies this peace and tranquility.
Yeah.
And, like, I have zero peace and I mean, like, I've tried to have peace and tranquility, but I hate meditating. I get super bored. Like, I hate most things that are, like, peaceful and tranquil, to be honest. And so as a result,
you can see the root of the problem.
Yeah, it is kind of the root of the problem. I think I'd rather be a happier person. But I think that the point is that when you talk about productivity and you talk about these contemplative routines, that it's not about saying, like, I want to have this, like, kumbaya moment where I can just take a deep breath and be mindful. It's about recognizing that, like, that's not going to happen for most people. And so if you build these routines, these habits into your life where you're telling yourself a story without even thinking about it, or you're trying to figure out how to find some choice and some chore that you have to do, or you're saying to your friends, like, or your colleagues, like, we've got 2 weeks to figure out some brand new way to maze everyone. Let's use this technique of taking old ideas and pushing them together. That doesn't feel like mindfulness. It doesn't feel like I have to, like, get in, like, the lotus position. Like, it feels like it's active. And I don't actually have to force myself to do it. It becomes automatic. But it forces me to think more. So I'll mention one other thing. Here's my favorite example of this thing. So Decrebny, the guy, the pilot that I mentioned, here's what's interesting about Decrebny. This is why I think he was actually able to pivot to this Cessna thing. Decrebny is acknowledged as one of the, I think I can say this on the radio, as one of the biggest assholes on the face of the planet. He is a man who will pick a fight with you over literally anything. One of his colleagues once told me he got into a half-hour argument with Decrebny about what the proper ingredients of a peanut butter and jelly sandwich are. Doesn't seem controversial.
Peanut butter and jelly.
Yeah, well, you'd think. But here's what's interesting about Decrebny. He's actually a very nice guy, although every conversation I had with him ended with us screaming at each other. Is that his contemplative routine, when he was in that shuttle and he would ask his co-pilots to tell him a story about what would happen if there was an emergency, he would argue with them about the story that they would tell. He would say, like, no, you say your eyes are going to go there, but why wouldn't they go over here? He is not a guy that you would want to have beers with. He is definitely a guy that you would want flying your airplane when there's a hole in the wing. Because he has this routine of challenging himself and everyone else about the mental models he's using. That was his letter writing, right? That's his contemplative practice. And that's kind of the point, is that nobody would say, like, picking fights with your friends is mindfulness. But it actually is. It's forcing him to think more. That all of us have these eccentricities, and we tend to discourage them. We tend to set them aside because they drive our friends or our wives crazy, or our husbands. But it's actually that eccentricity. That is how you achieve deeper thinking, because it just forces you to actually, like, break out of the reactive lifestyle.
Okay, I think we're ready for questions. And Pete, if you have a question, can you please line up over there? Oh, okay.
And by the way, feel free to tell me if you think that these ideas are wrong.
Right. Tell them if they're wrong. Also, feel free to ask questions about Charles's last book or
about just
habits
lives.
Or lives, anything else. Okay.
Thanks so much for sharing that. My name is Mike Wang.
You probably heard me already, but my name is Mike Wang. I work at a new university, so I'm going to ask maybe an education-focused question. I was just curious, based on the research that you've done around mental models and how folks might be educated to think like that, if you, in your research, did you encounter any sort of philosophies that might reinforce some of the things that you're saying? I went to a Jesuit school, so this notion of contemplation in action, for example, reminds me very much so of this iteration. You're replaying Kanye style, I guess, of your mental model piece. So I was just curious, have you talked to Jesuits? Have you thought through different mixes beforehand that might have existed for years linking to that? Does that make sense?
So I think it's a great question. And the answer I would give is this. So I think that in this contemporary age, there's a huge skepticism on the part of many people of philosophies that, like, previously would have been referred to as spiritual or religious practices. But what's interesting to me is that, like, if you look at the traditions that seem to have stuck with humanity for at least a couple thousand years, they tend to be these things that force us to think, right? It's like prayer. And it's usually not like silent prayer. Like the things that like are consistent are like the Talmud and arguing with other people about interpretations, or going to church and having someone challenge your interpretation of scripture, or it's going to concerts, or it's going to lecture series. The things that seem uniquely true of human culture are things that force us to think a little bit deeper. Now, what's interesting is that when I was doing this research, what I found was that every time this would come up with researchers, there was like this almost like visceral like reaction against it, that we live in this age that's supposed to be data-driven, and we're supposed to be able to prove everything, and that people are generally very wary of indulging too much in what seem like philosophical practices, because they're de classe right now. And it turns out that this is actually another marker usually of an economic revolution. That if you look at the Industrial Revolution from about 1890 to 1915 or so, and a little bit the Agrarian Revolution, is that you see these intense periods of people trying to grasp onto science to explain what is happening and pushing away things that seem non-scientific. But that ultimately, as you point out, that these aren't necessarily new ideas. They're just ideas that we have additional proof for that is more scientific.
Next question.
How does the maxim of do what you love relate to science of productivity? Like, because like a lot of the things we're talking about, like Facebook, you know, you might enjoy doing that, but is that what you love? Or like if you're at something that's unfulfilling, should you keep up with it because maybe you'll come to dividends later?
Let me answer that in two ways. The first of which is, one of the things that we know about self-motivation is that people tend to only generate self-motivation when they're working on things that seem to somehow link in a broad sense to their deepest values or ambitions.
That it seems meaningful to them.
That it seems meaningful, right. That like there has to be some inherent meaning to it. The second thing I would say, though, is there's very little evidence that doing what you love actually makes people happy. And there's a lot of evidence that being happy is vastly overrated. So what people actually find a lot of like satisfaction from typically is doing things that they become better at, right? So like how many people here like really, really love being on Facebook for more than like 10 or 15 minutes at a time? Like you find like, one person, Russ. Russ like loves it. He gets better at Facebook. Every time he's like, boom, killed it. So I think like what we know is that people become more productive when they become better at something. And as they become better at it, they tend to actually rate the pleasure that they get from that activity more, even if they don't necessarily enjoy the inherent activity.
Yeah, that's what games are about, right? Like, you love games because you get better at it over time.
That's exact. Or sports, or learning to read. Like there's a lot of evidence that like the best readers learn how to self-soothe through reading. So I think doing what you love, like following your passion, is somewhat overrated until you know what your passion is, and you tend to only learn that through becoming better at things. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Hi, my name is Sylvia, and I had a quick question. I'm trying to connect the dots between mental models. So if I go 5 degrees deeper into my day, how does that exactly help me to focus? Is that because I'm saying no to things that don't fit that mental model, and I'm saying yes to things that do?
Yeah, so what happens is that, and we know this from laboratory studies, when people build mental models, they tend to prime their attention to make decisions much, much faster about what to actually pay attention to, what to focus on, and what to ignore. And so basically, if you're telling yourself a story, I'm going to go into this meeting and I expect my boss to say X. Or actually, let me use a great example from the literature. Firefighters. The best firefighters are people who they walk into a burning building and they start immediately telling themselves a story about what they expect to see. I'm going to walk into this room and I expect to see flames in that corner, and there's a staircase over there, so I expect to see flames coming out of that staircase because staircases burn faster than everything else. And what happens is that as soon as they walk in and they see the flames out of that corner, that's expected. I don't have to pay much attention to that. But I look at that staircase and it's not on fire the way that I expected. immediately I start focusing much more on that staircase. I might ignore what's happening right in front of me because this might be a distraction. And I know not to walk up that staircase because something's wrong there. Your brain essentially is constantly looking for how to process the information around us. And all information looks equal without some criteria, some script to push it through. So what we're trying to do by just imagining our day is we're not going to be able to imagine perfectly what's going to happen. We're just trying to train ourselves what to pay attention to, what's important and what's unimportant. And somehow our brain takes this storytelling and it translates it into a just more highly attuned sense of being aware of what seems important and what doesn't. It doesn't mean you get it right all the time, but it does mean you're thinking a little bit more deeply about the information around you.
Next question.
Hi, I'm Gary. Seems a lot of what you're talking about is spontaneous thinking. But my question is, where does intuition fit into your model?
So I think in two ways. I think intuition, first of all, is building this mental model. But second of all, I'm happy you asked that question because there's a whole chapter on decision-making and about intuition. And as Farhad mentioned, one of the things that we know about people who seem to have really good intuition is that they seem to be more adept at envisioning multiple futures. Mm-hmm. So we now refer to this as Bayesian psychology because there's this basic question, which is if behavioral economics shows that we're like so dumb, how come so many of us like manage to feed and clothe ourselves every single day without getting killed? And it turns
out... Not all of us.
And not every day, but... So when you ask computers to solve some of the problems that humans have to solve, the only way that computers can do that is to use models that look like Bayesian models. Basically, models that make assumptions about the past, forecast multiple futures, and then start assigning likelihoods to those futures. And then as more evidence comes in, the computer will say like, oh, future B looks like it's a little bit more likely than future C, so I'm going to assume that that's true. People who are really good at thinking probabilistically, people who are good at making decisions, tend to do the same things. They push themselves to think about multiple futures. Now, here's an example of why this is something that's uncomfortable for us. When we have a friend who comes up and says, hey, I'm going to get married, it's totally natural for us to say, oh, tell me all about the proposal. Like, how did you know that you were in love with him or her? How did you decide to get married? How did you propose? When a friend comes up and says, I'm getting divorced, none of us say, oh, tell me all about the divorce. When did you realize you'd made a huge mistake? Was it like before the hooker came in or after the hooker came in? Like what was the like thought process there? We are so in love with staring at success and thinking of the future as binary outcomes that we tend to suppress this instinct to learn about negative events or to envision with as much specificity negative outcomes, right? We all think that we're going to start the company that works. But the best entrepreneurs, and we know this from studies that was done by this guy at USC, the best entrepreneurs spend a huge amount of time asking their friends why their companies failed, asking their friends why they got divorced. They tend to force themselves to think much more about the negative possible outcome, because that's how you start training your Bayesian intuition. That's how you start saying, there's actually 12 things that could happen here, and this is the most realistic likelihood of which one is going to occur.
What you're talking about is thinking. You can't get to you can't absorb intuition when you're thinking.
I think that they actually are I think that they reinforce each other, though. I think training yourself to think in a certain way develops your intuition.
Thank you.
Next.
Hello, my name is Utsab. So one thing I'm curious about is sometimes I think I might have a very strong mental model that's just bad for me. And I'm wondering, I mean, how can I know if a mental model is not serving me very well? Sometimes I wish there's like somebody who could just look at my mind and be like, okay, Utsab, here's your prescription. These are the beliefs that are not serving you well. These are the beliefs that are serving you well. Like,
You know, there are actually people who can do that. There's like a whole profession.
You know what I mean? Yeah, I guess like something that I find kind of paradoxical is that they say, you know, the last thing a fish will discover is water. And, you know, the like your deeper mental models might, you might never really discover them. Or I wonder if you've thought about this. Is there a strategy for getting rid of a bad mental model and moving towards like
right,
a
like if
one?
He had crashed the A380, you would have said, thinking of it as a Cessna was a dumb idea.
Yeah, well, yeah. We probably wouldn't know that he had...
Yes.
No. There's like 12 other guys who thought of their planes as Cessnas, and yeah. We don't have any idea. But no, it's a totally good question. And so I guess the way I'd answer it is this, that I think what you're really asking is like, what is the formula for success? Like what are the right mental models? What are the mental models... And unfortunately, I wish that I could tell you that there was this formula, but there just isn't, right? We know if somebody had figured it out, like we have figured out for a lot of things, but for the things that we care about right now, some people fail and some people succeed. And the difference, though, is that I think the people who are aware of their mental models, the people who are saying, like, look, I've been thinking this way for the last 20 years. Am I absolutely certain that this is the right way to think about it? I'm not even aware that I'm in the water. What can I do to make myself, force myself to think a little bit more deeply? I don't know that that's going to take you to the right answer right away, but I do know that that seems consistently to be the path towards eventually finding the right answer.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. You have a very good chapter, obviously, on decision-making, and you use the terminology Bayesian psychology. Is there actually a Bayesian technology?
The Bayesian psychologist, there's this emerging field of research that that tries to model our decision-making on Bayesian models. And my favorite example, actually, of like our capacity for Bayesian thinking is... If you show a computer a picture of a horse and a picture of a hairbrush, the computer will get confused with subsequent pictures, right? You have to do machine learning. You have to do training. If you show a 3-year-old a picture of a horse and a hairbrush, after one sample of each, they can distinguish with like 98% accuracy the difference between horses and hairbrushes. We seem to have this like amazing capacity. The only way that a computer can match that is to use some Bayesian learning algorithm where it makes predictions and it runs Monte Carlo simulations to forecast the horses and hairbrushes millions of times and assign likelihoods to the image it's about to see. We do that automatically. Our brains are designed to learn from our experiences and forecast what is going to happen. But the way that we get better at that, the way that we get better at intuition, is by forcing ourselves to envision more outcomes, to ask ourselves more accurately, what do I think is going to happen and why? And what happened in the past that was unexpected?
That is, on the basis of a healthy human being, we're a rational decision maker.
Exactly, yeah. Or at least rational in retrospect.
We have time for one more question.
Okay, I'll try to be fast. Hi, I'm Corey. And this has been an awesome talk, so thank you.
Oh, no, thank you.
I don't mean to be a little bit of a downer, but you're talking about pilots and firefighters got me thinking about law enforcement and the use of mental models in threat assessment. And we see it much more visibly today, which I think is a good thing, violent outcomes in interactions of police and the public. So I'm wondering if this thought around mental models could be leveraged or influenced in a way to... result in fewer harmful outcomes by law enforcement?
I think it's a great question. And it actually gets to this tension that I'll mention, which is there is a tension here between efficiency and productivity. So why do we have stop and frisk? Why do we have this like culture? And let me just say, like, I'm no expert on law enforcement, but why do we have this culture where it seems like we keep on seeing these instances of police officers making snap decisions that tend to be wrong decisions? It's because for a long time, it was super efficient to train them to be have a heightened response, right? The whole idea behind stop and frisk was stop a lot more people, search a lot more people, and try and figure out, like, open up your screening to many more inputs coming in. Now, that's super efficient. But the consequence of that is that you have this culture that grows over time where an outcome is that people make more mistakes, right? We know this from search functions, that if you let in more inputs, your error rate goes up. And as a result, there's this tension between efficiency and productivity, between creating police forces that very efficiently cut down on crime, and we are living at a time when crime is at an all-time low. We are safer than we've ever been before, unless you are tragically a member of a family who has had someone unjustly killed, in which case you don't care about the efficiency. You just care about the productivity. You care about cops not making mistakes and doing their jobs well. This is a tension of this economic revolution, is trying to figure out where as a society and where as individuals we feel like we should be more efficient and we feel like we should be more productive, because it inevitably brings up questions of justice and of values and of what kind of world we want to live in. And I think we're going to continue fighting over that, hopefully with less occurrences, but for the next couple of years.
And, yes, we... So that's the end of the audience questions. We always end at Inforum with a with the same. It's a tradition to end with this question. Charles, what is your 60-second idea to change the world? I don't know if we have a timer.
I might need more than 60 seconds. Russ is counting down. Okay, so let me answer that by telling a story. So before, because that's clearly the most efficient thing. Okay, so before I came, so my wife and I used to live in the Bay Area. And I told her I was coming out to do this, and I was really excited about it because I love the Commonwealth Club, and like I've listened to it on the radio for years. And I said, what if I, like, because it's so much fun, and I like San Francisco because it's like weird and kooky, and I love that about San Francisco. What if I did like something crazy, like I had like a marching band or fireworks or something, I don't know. And my wife said to me, and this is a little, she said, that is the most jackass idea I've ever heard in my entire life. You will look like a total douchebag. And so... So I totally agreed with that, but then I made this argument, which I believe in, which this is my 60-second idea, which is that the most productive people, they tend, the same way that Bayesian psychology, they tend to envision multiple futures. The most productive people, one of the things we know about them is that they don't look at decisions as good or bad, as binary outcomes, success or failure. What they tend to do is they tend to look at decisions as experiments. And I said to my wife, who happens to be she's a marine biologist, she's an actual scientist, so she loves it when I lecture her on how scientists think. I said to my wife, you know, if we were thinking like a scientist, we would do something crazy, because as long as we get data from it, it's not a bad choice. And she said, and I was like, I don't know, like we could get like a mariachi band or like hand throw cookies into the crowd. And she said once again, you will look like a jackass if you did that. But here is my 60-second idea, is as long as it's an experiment, as long as we get data from it, it is not a jackass idea. And so with that, allow me to introduce the El Mariachi Nuevo Generation and all the cookies you can possibly eat. Thanks, guys.
Wow.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks for coming.